Friday, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Cutler Hour. I am your host, Michael Cutler. It's great joining you September 27th, 2013 evening, 7 p.m. Eastern Time. You have to look at your own watch to know where you are and when you are. But it is always great playing the game of catch-up with you at the end of the week. Lots going on, lots to talk about. I'm expecting my good friend, political activist and South Carolinian, a lawyer by the name of Lauren Martell, to be joining me shortly. Lauren and I go back a couple of years. In fact, 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, I guess it was, about 2 years ago, she first chatted with me, and we decided that we could work together on many of these issues. She got me invited to the South Carolina Tea Party Convention. I was thrilled to be one of the speakers there. This was during the presidential campaign. And eventually, I did a second appearance at that same convention. I hope to join them again this year. We'll see what happens. But those of you who are familiar with me, familiar with this program, know that I'm a retired senior special agent with what used to be the Immigration and Naturalization Service, the INS. The mission of immigration has now been given over under the Department of Homeland Security, as I prefer to call it, the Department of Homeland Surrender, to the men and women of ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, to CBP, Customs and Border Protection, and to United States Citizenship and Immigration Services. The employees of those agencies really and truly want to do a great job, but there's a wonderful Yiddish expression that says that when a fish goes bad, it smells from the head. Washington is the problem. Washington is the problem because immigration has become so thoroughly politicized that the job is no longer being done. It's a particularly upsetting situation, worrying situation, because our immigration laws and our borders are designed to do just two fundamental things: protect American lives and protect the jobs of American workers. Both issues high on the list of items that we need to be concerned about in this dangerous era. We just saw the terrorist attacks in Kenya at the mall. And you know, what was astonishing for me was that with all of the news coverage that was devoted nearly 24/7 for four solid days, there was speculation about risks to America, risks to American malls and other such venues. There were a parade of experts that appeared on all the major television networks talking about how vulnerable we might or might not be. Congressman Peter King, who had previously chaired the Homeland Security Committee in the House of Representatives, he's a New Yorker. He's from Long Island, right here in New York, east of New York City, speculated on the dangers posed by the Somalis who might go bad in Minnesota and elsewhere. And certainly this isn't to throw mud on any group of Americans or immigrants or refugees. There are many decent folks who come here, not just from Somalia, but from many parts of the world who simply want to become part of the American tapestry. Certainly no country is more diverse than is the United States. But the concern we have is that among the refugees that we have admitted into the United States have been a host of terrorists. If you go back to 1993, an individual by the name of Amil Kansi, a Pakistani national, applied for political asylum, lied through his teeth, and the public record on it is a little bit blurred, but he either received political asylum or was still being considered for it when he took an AK-47 and shot up the CIA. He killed two CIA officers and wounded three others as they were driving into the parking lot at the CIA compound. And he had scoped out that facility by driving a messenger truck for several months, which gave him camouflage and the opportunity for surveillance. You know, terrorists tend to have jobs in the United States. When you provide employment authorization to aliens whose identities, backgrounds, and intentions can't be verified, you open the door to the potential that you might be aiding and abetting terrorists. And in fact, I like to make the point that the day before a terrorist attack, a terrorist is likely to go to the job where he or she has been working, perhaps for years, hiding in plain sight, waiting for the phone call, waiting for that tap on the shoulder, Cansey did it January 93, and a month later, a guy by the name of Ramzi Youssef was one of the ringleaders of the first bombing at the World Trade Center. And then we just saw the Tsarnaev brothers, same deal. They apparently got political asylum by lying on their applications. I'm not making an allegation, but I am telling you that that is what, to me, with 30 years of experience conducting immigration investigations, has to call into question, because to be eligible for political asylum, you have to articulate credible fear. If your fear is so credible that you tell America, we can't go back to our home country because we will be persecuted or face perhaps death, why is it that the Tsarnaev family, right after they got political asylum 10 years ago, immediately went back to Russia? Somebody at ICE needs to look at that and say, wait a minute, something's wrong with this picture. So, you know, I'm a big fan of political asylum. I just wrote an article I'd love for you folks to go check out at The Social Contract, Political Asylum, where compassion and national security intersect. I'm a fan of political asylum and helping the people who are vulnerable, but we need to make certain that we don't allow the bad guys, the terrorists, to see in our kindness and compassion an opportunity to enter the country and embed themselves. There's two other websites I'm going to mention to you, and then I'm going to bring my guest on, or co-host, or whatever hat we will have her wear this evening, Lauren Martel. But the two websites I very much want you to visit so you can find out more about me and get some really great perspectives, not just from me, and I hope you like what I have to say and what I have to write. I presume that's why you're listening this evening. But CAPS, Californians for Population Stabilization, have a bunch of writers. We don't always agree with each other on everything, and that's what's great about America. But the fundamental issues of protecting America, protecting our borders, not flooding America with more people than we can deal with, not flooding communities with more people who we can deal with, is vital. You know, there comes a point when we have to understand, once again I will make the point, that our borders and immigration laws exist for two primary purposes: to protect the lives and livelihoods of Americans. So CAPSWeb.org is the website for CAPS, Californians for Population Stabilization, great organization in beautiful downtown Santa Barbara. My own personal website is michaelcutler.net. If you like what you see, pass it along to friends and neighbors. This is about education. I like to say I'm trying to create a bucket brigade of truth. Same thing with my own website, michaelcutler.net. The politicians and the news media, for the most part, are not giving you the straight scoop on immigration. It's not about Mexicans. It's not about Latinos. It's about national security. It's about the economy, the environment, healthcare, education. It's about people from the four corners of the planet. And the only distinction that our immigration laws make, it has nothing to do with race, religion, or ethnicity. It's about whether or not you're a citizen or an alien. And an alien, by the way, in our laws, is simply defined as any person, not a citizen or national of the United States. There's no insult to be found there, folks. Just clarity. And the folks on the other side of this debate, and it's hard to believe given all the circumstances that there is even a debate, they would blur that distinction because they know that the truth, common sense, and morality and the law are all opposed to their wacky position, which I see as nothing less than a betrayal of America and Americans. Lauren Martel, happy Friday. I know you're there. I hear you breathing.
You do?
Good for you
oh my
to
God.
Join me.
Huh? So funny. I should mute it. I'm so sorry. Did I sound like a heavy breather? I apologize.
Well, I was hoping it was an obscene phone call. No, actually.
Well, I'm doing really well. This was a particularly amazing week. And so, you know, good things happen in the midst of you know, craziness, in the midst of this crazy world that we're living in and some of the very serious issues that we're going to talk about tonight. But I always remember, and it's always verified really on a daily basis, that there are really great people in this, in America and in our world, and that we should really continue to set the bar high for a standard of, you know, shining light as much as we can. I was really thinking as I was listening to you talk about, you know, a drawing board and just given any individual the opportunity to create a picture of what they wanted the world to look like or what they wanted to accomplish, you know, in their life, almost a life purpose, as I've, you know, seen a few of my, you know, people that I've known recently pass away or get older. And, you know, you look at what is an individual's purpose in life and what really makes life worthwhile. And it's such a different picture, I think, from the people that I, you know, tend to surround myself with compared to what these guys who would go into a mall, you know, in Kenya or anywhere else and create that kind of a picture. So, you know, I took a step back just to think, you know, what makes people do that kind of thing and where does it really come from, you know?
Well, you know, I had a partner way back when I was an agent, my good friend Jerry England. And Jerry used to look at a situation. And I have to tell you, folks, I am firmly convinced, you know, too many years in law enforcement, I think we're all professional cynics if you carry a gun and a badge. Normal is illusory. There is no such thing as normal. Execute enough warrants and you will be convinced that everybody's a little bit wacky. It's a matter of in what direction, to what extent. And he used to have a wonderful expression. He'd look at a bizarre set of circumstances and he'd say to me, Mike, I wonder what the color of the sky is in this guy's world, because sure as hell it's not blue. And you wind up thinking about that all the time. What person in their right mind could possibly injure somebody intentionally or kill somebody they don't even know? You know, you understand, and I'm not justifying it, but we hear these stories about rage where there's a guy has a fight with somebody and they wind up, you know, going after each other and someone's terribly injured or killed or whatever. And you say to yourself, well, boy, that guy really got out of control. But you understand that the other guy who started the fight, and this is where it wound up. And again, I'm not justifying ever violence. I think violence shouldn't even be considered a viable option. Although as a school kid, I had my share of fist fights. I guess we all did growing up. But you can understand the guy that's been angry at somebody for a long period of time, and it festers, and eventually violence erupts, and there's a murder. But when you look at sociopathic terrorists who can walk into a mall and target people, as they did in Kenya, because of their religious belief or lack of agreement with their own religious belief, and kill children, and kill women, and kill old people. You know, I carried a gun as an agent for three centuries, right? It seems like three centuries. And I used to say a little prayer every morning that I wouldn't have to use my firearm. I love target shooting. I enjoy going to a range. But nobody in their right mind ever wants to have a human being in the sights when you pull the trigger. I came close on a number of occasions to having to use deadly force. Each time, thank God, the person surrendered at the last moment. So deadly force was taken off the table, and I went home with a great sense of relief. If you are normal, you don't want to shoot somebody. And here we had mass carnage in a mall, civilians going about their lives last Saturday, not quite a week ago, having no idea that they were sealing their fate by walking into an upscale mall in Kenya. And it was a beautiful mall. I've spoken to people who've been in that mall. Nobody could have imagined it any more than the passengers on those four airliners on September 11th, 2001, or any more than those runners at the Boston Marathon on April 15th of this year. And in fact, I don't know if you've been following the coverage. Do you know that it is now believed that these terrorists had actually rented a store in the mall so that they could scope it out?
Yeah, they really are extraordinarily intentional and prepared. You know, in doing some of my research, I'm going back to seeing some of these kind of style, I guess they call it Mumbai-style assaults that, you know, are really around the world. And you know, so they there's definitely an intent there, a mens rea, so to speak, of this kind of a style of attack. And you know, they really call places like a mall or just like you were saying, you know, sort of public places where, you know, quote unquote, in some of the articles they call them hapless citizens. But you know, really they're just good, decent people going out and, you know, doing what they do on a daily basis. But they call this situation a soft target. And it's really because people there don't expect something so awful or violent. And they really have a reason to, you know, an expectation of safety. I mean, in our country, up until really very recently, even after 9/11, I still had a fairly high standard or an expectation of reasonable safety. I don't think that we can bank on that anymore. I think that people who...
And you know, you raised Mumbai, and here's an interesting point. Mumbai used to be called Bombay, and then they changed the name of the city from Mumbai to Bombay, from Bombay, rather, to Mumbai. It's believed that the people that attacked the hotel had worked in the hotel. So here's what's so crazy. I want you to stop and think about how chilling this is. Some of the people that worked in the hotel were probably killed by the terrorists, and they were working side by side with those terrorists possibly for weeks, because their goal was to learn the layout of the hotel, to learn about how everyone got access to different areas, to acquire keys and passes and so forth, to get from one section of the hotel to the other, from the swimming pool to the exercise rooms to the storage rooms to hotel rooms, where apparently they had stashed away explosives and weapons. So imagine what kind of evil you're talking about. People that you'd be working with, and suddenly they wake up one morning and say, today's the day. And the people that every day they would greet and say, how are you? How are things? How's your family? They probably got to know who was married and who had children, and then gun them down without a moment of hesitation. Think of what kind of a level of insanity you're dealing with, folks. And now let's look at what we're not doing to protect America or Americans and understand why I am so concerned about immigration, the subject that nobody would talk about all week. Nobody, not one program, said, hey, you know, what we are doing in America is ignoring the findings and the recommendations of no less an authority than the 9/11 Commission. We're still seeing politicians, right up to right now, today, this afternoon, talking about the need to provide Dreamers with identity documents, and indeed the administration right now, and by the way, there was a second or a third story that overlays with all of this, and this was the story about the disclosure of the NSA secrets by Snowden, the shooting, the horrific mass shooting at the Navy base, and some people are saying, well, how in the world did they do background checks on those people? Well, first of all, both Snowden and the shooter at the Navy base did not have background checks. They had full background investigations. They had secret clearances. I had a secret clearance. And a secret clearance, I actually had a top secret clearance. Every 5 years, you're called into a room with one or more investigators, in this case from a private company. It used to be done by the FBI and other federal agencies. And the investigators can talk to you for a half hour. They can talk to you for 8 hours. They decide how long the interview will run. They decide what questions they need to ask you. They decide what questions are relevant based on where the discussion goes. If they ask you a question and the answer you provide opens up other doors, then they're going to have to go through those doors. For example, do you have any relatives who are in jail? Do you know this? Do you know that? Well, if some guy says, yeah, my brother's in jail. Well, what did he do? Well, he was an embezzler, really, and where did he work? So now they're going to go down that avenue. And I fortunately am not in that situation, but that's how thorough the interview is. And then the investigators go out on the street and knock on doors and speak to neighbors and speak to your colleagues, speak to people that you may have worked with 10 years ago. It's supposed to be very thorough. And even then, obviously, there were failings. Now, a background check simply means you run a name that the person puts down on an application and the fingerprints they provide. So if you have the fingerprints, that may not tell you anything, because terrorists who've never been arrested in the United States probably will come back with their prints showing no record, unless they were arrested in England or Canada or some other country that we work closely with. From the Middle East, not likely. So if they provide a false name and they provide their fingerprints, the likelihood is quite high that these people are going to easily pass a background check. The Obama administration right now is providing aliens who are up to 31 years of age on paper. In reality, they could be 35, you know. If the guy lies about his name, he can lie about his date of birth. You can't look at somebody who says he's 30 and say, oh, no, he's 32. No one's that good. So you're not even certain about their actual date of birth or their name or their country of citizenship or when they got here. The interview is not...
And, you know, what Al-Shabaab means in Arabic is youth, anyway. So
youth, that's right. You're reading my mind. So if you look...
I can add that to my resume now.
You can add that to your resume. Mike Cutler's mind reader. But here's the deal. Al-Shabaab does mean youth. And if you look at the profile of the average terrorist, it is a person under the age of 30. It coincides perfectly with the so-called DREAM Act. And they are not even doing the face-to-face interview, folks. They certainly are not going out and knocking on anybody's door to ask anybody questions. All that the adjudications officer does is look at the material submitted in an envelope by an applicant for lawful status, temporary lawful status, and an identity document that can be used as a breeder document. So a guy who was from Iran, for example, who may have lived in Venezuela for 5 years, because we know we have Iranian shock troops arriving every week directly from Tehran to Caracas, could easily say, instead of saying, my name is Mohammed whoever, my name is Miguel whoever. He would then get an official identity document that attests to the fact that he has a Latino last name and that he's here from Venezuela or Mexico or Brazil or wherever. Now, understand the national security risk. And then, you know, we're told, well, if we have these aliens and they want to become part of America, then let's let them become members of the military. Let's look at what happened with the Zetas, the Mexican drug gang. They originally were the elite of Mexican military and Mexican law enforcement. We gave them the training. We gave them weapons. We taught them our playbook, and they became Los Zetas, the most violent of all the drug cartels in Mexico. Originally, when they went south, when they went bad, literally went south, they were working as the enforcers for the other cartels, and then they decided, why in the world are we working for these people? We can kill them and take over their business. And that's what Los Zetas did. We trained them. And you add that to Fast and Furious, the 2,000 or more assault weapons that went down to Mexico. You look at Major Nadal Hassan. Now, look, we have plenty of foreign nationals in our military who are loyal, who have, in fact, given their lives for us. And I'm not trying to discredit them or throw mud or besmirch them. But we don't know who in the world we're allowing in. This is a game of Russian roulette. And let me read one little brief paragraph. And this is really super important, folks. This piece appeared in nothing less than the 9/11 Commission report on how the terrorists attacked us. It appears on page 68. This will blow your mind. As early as December 1993, a team of al-Qaeda operatives had begun casing targets in Nairobi for future attacks. The places they were looking at, by the way, were the embassies. If you remember the two embassy bombings that preceded 9/11. And here's where they were discussing how that attack occurred on our embassies. So let me go back and read this again. As early as December 7th, 1993, a team of al-Qaeda operatives had begun casing targets in Nairobi for future attacks. It was led by Ali Mohammed, a former Egyptian army officer who had moved to the United States in the mid-1980s, enlisted in the U.S. Army, and became an instructor at Fort Bragg. He had provided guidance and training to extremists at the Farouk Mosque in Brooklyn, including some who were subsequently convicted in the February 1993 attack of the World Trade Center. Now, think about what that says. We allowed somebody into our military. He became an officer. He became a trainer. And all the time, he was a radical Islamist who was involved, becomes involved in the bombing of the U.S. embassy and becomes involved in training others who tried to bring down the World Trade Center in 1993. What we are doing, if you look at the 9/11 Commission report, is utterly ignoring it. It's as though there was no 9/11 Commission report. You know, when there's a plane crash, the NTSB, the National Traffic and Safety Administration, send in their people. They do the investigation. They try to find out how an airplane became a smoking hole in the ground and killed lots of people. And when they make recommendations, they must be adhered to. It's not optional. Nobody says, well, if you feel like doing this, if you don't mind, we hate to bother you. No, no, no. the NTSB says this is the way you're going to do business, and from that day forward, that's how pilots and airlines operating in the United States must conduct themselves. That was the same purpose behind the 9/11 Commission.
But, you know, and I mean, I've read the 9/11 Commission report, and I want to rely on it. I want to cite it all the time. But, you know, Mike, I think that there's just a competing document that is winning the minds and playing on deceiving the hearts of the greedy, and it's the North American Alliance kind of attitude, sort of a structure in place that was created, you know, in early 2000, really sort of coming to fruition, and you know, in 2005, it goes back to, you know, NAFTA and even before that, though. And this is the idea that we need to almost merge, just like you and I have talked on many occasions. America becomes blurred to the point that it includes Canada and Mexico. And I truly believe that some of those documents that suggest that this is the way to go are the documents that people who are in power and have the platform, are they're relying on those documents. And they ignore the 9/11.
They are, and there's something else called the Discover America Partnership, concocted by the hotel, hospitality, travel industries, aided and embedded and encouraged and funded by the Chamber of Commerce. They've now added manufacturing associations, and they're pushing for the expansion of the visa waiver program. You know, it was remarkable, and, you know, I provided testimony to the 9/11 Commission that I've made these points when I've appeared before congressional hearings, both in the House and Senate. And if you look at the way that the law is and the importance of visas, when you require an alien to fill out a form for a visa, the application contains about 40 questions. Even if the person is going to lie on it, they're going to tell the truth on some questions. So down the road, if that person becomes the target of an investigation, that application has valuable leads. If an alien lies on the application and it can be discovered that the alien did lie, it's called visa fraud. And the penalties are severe. If you lie just to come here perhaps to work, you're looking at 10 years in jail. If you lie on the application to commit a crime, maybe they're coming to commit a bank robbery or a kidnapping, you get charged with visa fraud in conjunction with a crime, the penalty's 15 years in jail. If the crime involves drugs, it goes to 20 years in jail. If it involves terrorism, it goes to 25 years in jail. Okay? There's another point. If an alien is required to have a visa, can't get one, airlines will not board them because they will look at the person's passport and say, oh, you're a citizen of Israel. You're a citizen of whatever. You don't have a visa. We're not going to let you on board the airplane because the airline gets fined if they fly somebody to the United States without a valid visa in their passport and they're required to have one. So this helps to keep terrorists off of airliners. Think about that. It also helps the inspector sitting in that booth at a port of entry, and I did that job for the first 4 years of my life. You're only supposed to spend a minute interviewing the person. So that visa process can be a pre-screening process to help make the system a little bit more effective. Additionally, there are times when you want to arrest a bad guy who's part of a criminal or terrorist organization, but you don't want his cohorts to know that you're onto them. When I was up at DEA Intelligence, or when I was up at the FBI, and I worked with those folks because I spent half my career with the Drug Task Force, I've also arrested suspected terrorists in my career. So if you arrest somebody on an immigration charge, they don't realize that you're part of a team of DEA or FBI or ATF agents. The other alternative is if you don't go after the visa, then you really want the guy off the street, then you're going to arrest the guy perhaps and charge him with a crime that relates back directly to the organization he's part of, and now you've tipped your hand to everybody that the entire organization is likely under investigation. So if I could take a guy off the street and charge him with reentry after deportation, which for criminals, by the way, carries a 20-year penalty. And by the way, this is kind of interesting. You know, I worked with Senator D'Amato to create that law back in the early 80s. And when you're told, well, it's not a crime to run the border, if you were previously deported and you're an alien with a criminal background, you run the border, you're looking at 20 years in jail. It sure as hell is a crime to run that border. So, again, it's another lie, another bit of twisted information. Oh, it's not a crime to run the border. If you were previously deported, it carries a max of 20 years in jail if you're a criminal alien. That's to the federal standards, for any standard, a 20-year jail sentence is a serious crime. Now, the final thing is that even if an alien applies for a visa and doesn't get one, the application remains on file permanently. That's something that I pushed for when I did my very first congressional hearing back May 20th, 1997, on the issue of visa fraud and immigration benefit fraud. And here's what's interesting. That hearing was convened midway between the terror attacks of 93 at the World Trade Center and at the CIA and the 9/11 attack that would take place 4 years after that hearing. So it took us more time for the government to hold a hearing into visa fraud and benefit fraud because of the terrorist attacks of 93 than it took us to win the Second World War. And the Clinton administration did nothing to change the equation where visa issuance or the adjudication of immigration benefits was concerned. In fact, it was during the Clinton administration that a program known as Citizenship USA provided over 1 million aliens with United States citizenship. We're not just talking about admitting them. And it turned out that tens of thousands of them, according to the Inspector General and the General Accountability Office, were statutorily ineligible for naturalization. It turned out that many times they didn't even wait for the fingerprints to come in. There were allegations being made by district directors. These are the people that run major field offices, that they were threatened with being fired outright if they didn't approve, not just get rid of the backlog, but approve a minimum quota. This was a subversion of the entire naturalization process. So if you look at all of these factors and then recognize one thing, under the visa waiver program, all those wonderful benefits that we apply to America's national security evaporate. The visa requirement, in essence, pushes America's borders out from the Rio Grande and the Canadian border and our coastal regions all the way to the embassies and consulates where we issue the visas. On 9/11, 26 countries participated in the visa waiver program. Today, ladies and gentlemen, 37 countries participate. So as the searches of passengers getting on airplanes get ever more intrusive, we are making it ever easier for foreign nationals. Today, we're talking about 37 countries to come to the United States without first applying for a visa.
Hey, look, Mike, you know, Paul Revere, if he were around living today, he'd say, one if by land, 430,000 if by the Rio Grande. I love that joke. But, you know,
I actually used that analogy, and I said he only needed three candles for the two possibilities, one if by land, two if by sea. Today, you have any lanterns he would need? There's visa fraud, there's getting married to an American, there's claiming to be a student when you're not, there's stowing away on a ship, there's... You know, we can go
we
on forever.
Solar,
Home Depot doesn't have enough lanterns for Paul Revere.
No doubt. Well, listen, here's a couple things that what you were just talking about brought into my mind. And one deals with a conversation that was so poignant that you and I actually were having maybe a week ago. And it was about the travel industry. And it was about, you know, what makes people do stupid things and then have to deal with the unintended consequences after they make choices, bad choices. And I think, you know, you had brought up, look, the guys that rode the Concorde, the mega billionaires at the time in 2001, you know, were killed. So by, you know, sort of compromising security and allowing cheap labor or whatever it was that these people were kind of trying to do, it ends up, you know, you might get a short-term profit, but in the long run, you could lose your entire industry. Why don't you, you know, that's something that I would love to hear you speak a little bit more about. And then the second that and we can get to the second thing if you want to just talk about that, and then I'll just bring up the second thing on the Somali guys in not only, you know, Minnesota, but also Somali guys in Ohio, which is, you know, bizarrely of a hugely large Somali population there. So anyway,
go ahead. Yeah. All right, so here's the thing. First of all, when you are greedy and all you think about is the bottom line, you get a, you know, it's the old story about being penny wise and pound foolish. That's the expression. I haven't used it in a long time. Penny wise, pound foolish. And you know, the analogy is the guy that goes out and spends a gazillion dollars on the latest Ferrari and decides to save money by not changing the oil on the car. And he does real well until the day the engine seizes on the highway, and he now has an engine that needs to be replaced, and it costs him, you know, $100,000, where all he had to do was invest in periodic engine oil changes. The people that are so greedy that they want to make it easy for travelers to come here for tourism, trade, and so forth, are forgetting what had happened to the tourism industry in the wake of 9/11. If you think back 12 years ago, this time 12 years ago, it was seen as a heroic act to get on an airplane and fly to New York or a major city. Most airplanes were flying empty. Most of New York's hotels were at least half empty or more. Many of the restaurants had no customers. Broadway had no customers. Nobody wanted to come to New York because everybody said, oh my God, this is dangerous. I don't want to go there. They were begging people on programs, come to New York. It's the American thing to do. We stand with America, on and on and on. We stand with New York. People didn't want to come here. There are places that went out of business because of that. And there was a program on television about flying supersonic, and it was the whole story of the Concorde and how the accident took place. There had been a prior accident with a Concorde. And in France, it was a little different, I guess, than the United States. They were told of the modifications they needed to make on the Concorde, and they didn't do it. And they believed that if the modifications had been made, then the crash that brought down the Concorde in France that signaled really the end of it wouldn't have happened. So they didn't see that the requirements discovered by their own authorities as a mandate. They didn't want to spend the money on lining the fuel tanks with Kevlar, which is what they ultimately did, which would have prevented that attack, which really marked the beginning of the end for Concorde. But then they made the point that the Concorde flights became more and more and more costly, and they were catering to a very elite group of travelers. Initially, I think a Concorde seat, when I was at the airport, I actually got to sit in the captain's seat, the pilot seat of the Concorde. I was an inspector at the airport at the time, and Air France was showing us the airplane and so forth. There was a big controversy because of how much noise they would make. So I actually got to sit in the pilot seat of the Concorde after it pulled in. It was very exciting. I did a little single-engine flying as a kid. I've never been a big sports guy. The national figures who I've always looked up to were the astronauts and test pilots. I got letters from some of the astronauts, Alan Shepard and Gus Grissom. I had the privilege of meeting some of the astronauts. So I'm all about aviation. And so here I was on this Concorde, and I watched as the price soared into the stratosphere. Towards the end of the flights of the Concorde, they were charging, I believe it was at least $5,000 per seat. And the only people who were really able to afford it were movie stars and the Wall Street bankers, flying, I guess, on our money, of course, but that's a story that we can talk about later. But what they had said was that on 9/11, when the towers came down, they lost at least 40 of their regular customers who would routinely get on board the Concorde to jet off for a weekend in Europe or a week in New York. So this is not in the best interests of the hotel, travel, or hospitality industries either, but they're being too greedy and too short-sighted to look down the road and say, you know, if we don't keep the travel situation safe, we're going to pay a price. This reminds me of what the Ford Motor Company did with the exploding gas tanks in the Ford Pinto. For those of you too young to remember.
By the way, my parents actually had a Ford Pinto, I'm not going to lie. And thankfully, we had hedges of protection around us, because I do believe back in the 70s in a Ford Pinto, they put four children and two parents, and they were smoking. But that's just, you know, I was destined for a purpose to survive something like that.
You survive. We should get you a bumper sticker that says, I survived the Ford Pinto.
No doubt.
But here was an amazing story, because they were competing with the Volkswagen. Mother Jones magazine broke the story, by the way. They were competing with Volkswagen, so they made the car very flimsy, no bumpers. The body didn't have much structure solidity, so in an accident, the body would twist so badly the doors tended to jam shut. And because there were no bumpers, and there was just flimsy metal holding the gas tank together, the gas tank would very often be driven into the rear axle or the differential. I forgot exactly what the mechanics were of the accident. And typically, in a 20-mile crash, which is not one of these catastrophic crashes, a 20-mile-an-hour crash, was enough to rupture the gas tank, and it caused an explosion, and people burned to death in the car. Now, there were apparently meetings held at Ford Motor Company at the time where they were actually sitting around a conference table, if you could imagine this, saying, well, it would cost us $11 to fix each car, but if we get sued by the victims of a fire, it will cost us less per year, according to our estimates, than simply fixing the car at $11 a pop. Now, as far as I'm concerned, anybody involved in that decision should have spent the rest of their life in a cage known as a jail cell. But they did the math, and the math said that a car crash that would cost the lives of the occupants by burning to death, I can't imagine a worse way to die, $11 a car is too great a price to pay. If I was running the, and in fact, it was funny because it was Volvo that Ford agreed afterwards that safety did sell. Initially, they said safety didn't sell. Now, I don't know if he said it. They attributed it to Lee Iacocca. I don't know. He always seemed to be that avuncular sort of guy who came up with the Mustang, which was brilliant. If he said it, shame on him or worse. But eventually, they came to understand that safety does sell. You can't watch a car commercial today where they don't do a crash test. You know, they've made stars out of the crash dummies. They could probably put them, some of them could replace members of Congress to everybody's advantage.
Right.
But every car, though, whether it's BMW or Mercedes or Volvo or General Motors or Toyota, they always show the crash tests. And they always brag how their car gets a five-star safety rating. And every year they make the tests tougher because safety does sell. And what I would argue is that if I was an executive in the travel industry, rather than push for an expansion of the visa waiver program, I'd be pushing for the U.S. government to be more careful about who we allow on the airplanes and let into the country, and I would launch a public relations campaign the way Volvo did about seatbelts. And I don't know if you remember the seatbelt commercials. You're a lot younger than I am, Lauren, but they took a car, and it was a model car, a little toy car, and they had a seat with a seatbelt. And they took an egg and they put it on one seat that had no seatbelt. The other seat had a seatbelt, and they smacked it into a wall. The egg that was in the seat that wasn't buckled in became an omelet. The other egg emerged unscathed, and they said, this is why you need to wear seatbelts. This is why we're giving you seatbelts even before the law required them. And people bought it. They said, hey, I've seen a bad accident. We've all seen terrible accidents. Maybe some of us, God forbid, have been involved in bad accidents. So people know that you can get hurt when you're going down a highway. So why in the world aren't the people in the travel, hotel, and hospitality industries simply saying to people, listen, it's a pain in the neck to get a visa. We know that. But imagine if you're willing to spend the better part of one day every 5 or 8 years or whatever it is, and know that you and everyone else is a lot safer because we're being more careful as to who we're allowing on airplanes and who we are allowing to travel between countries, people would accept that. You know, I might even give people booklets with crossword puzzles and other things to keep them occupied and have a lot of ads in there for travel to England, travel to France, come to New York. And I would have, you know, crossword puzzles and stuff, almost like what they give out on the airplanes when you fly. You know, they always have their own corporate in-flight magazine. Why not give out the equivalent of that magazine explaining why it's important that the government does what it does to keep us safe and see this as a public relations campaign rather than as something that shouldn't be done?
That would be a great idea. That actually, you know, honestly, that was the free markets at work. That was back when the free markets weren't suffocated to death so that they could work. And honestly, I submit to you that when the free markets do work and people are safe and allowed to get engaged in entrepreneurialism, then, you know, the competition and the bar gets so raised. Inventions are made, you know, right and left, and countries prosper. But you know what this ties into, Mike? And I'm just going to tell you, we don't plan this. You know, sometimes we just really ad-lib sometimes on the hour that I'm honored to be a guest on your show. But, you know, the thing that is in my mind is really that there's 20 holders of U.S. passports, allegedly, among the 250 foreign fighters in Somalia with al-Shabaab. And, you know, some of them are still over there. The question becomes, you know, what happens when they return here? But I read a quote from the guy who runs Mall of America. And, you know, basically after all this, you know, the guy was like, speaking of safety, this is what the Mall of America guy says, right? He goes, I think if you're for 100% safety, you should probably wrap yourself up in bubble wrap and never leave home, said Doug Reynolds, security director of the Mall of America. Because, you know, obviously after this whole Kenya Mall situation happened, the question became, okay, some of these guys are in the United States. They're in Ohio. They're in Minnesota. They're in Missouri. They're being radicalized. And you know I love people, so I'm not coming against any Muslims or any people in particular. But I am standing against doctrine that allows people to go in all weekend long, these youth, okay? They're like, you know, younger than 18 and 18. And it's not just necessarily in the mosque. It's also in the healthcare clinics, and it's also in daycare centers, you know? And so allowing these places, you know, where you think you're going and you're getting some help, or people go on the weekends and they hang out all weekend, becoming radicalized here in the United States. And then when you really take a bigger picture of, you know, has a mall shooting ever really happened in America? Well, yeah. In 2007, and a couple in 2007, one in 2012. Most of these have been what's perceived as carried out by young lone gunmen with no apparent cause. But the point is that when you talk about a war, a terroristic war, okay, it hits us financially. I mean, they don't have to win a kinetic battle. They don't always have to win the theater of the military.
No, and that's what you're describing is asymmetrical warfare. This is really what the goal is.
And so if we can be crippled, I mean, just think of the people who probably are going to stay home from malls or definitely going to think twice about lingering in a mall, you know, because all of a sudden their sense and perception of safety, and we don't have anybody coming up and saying they're going to create a new seat belt. So, like Volvo, you know, like we got safer cars, and the Pinto, you know, it corrected itself, and some good trial lawyers, because there are some great trial lawyers out there, you know, did their job and brought home, you know, the scales of justice into a more balanced position. I submit that lawyers aren't even, you know, we all want to sue. We want to sue on RICO statutes. It blows my mind that we're waiting for Chuck Schumer to do some legislation, and I'm looking into that legislation, you know, because some people ask me, you know, well, what's it? And I know I'm really appreciative of you weighing in on it. You know, but here's the thing is, victims of these kind of terrorist attacks, you'd think that they'd just be able to go into court and sue civilly and get some, you know, remedy, some restitution. They actually have to get special legislation to even allow them to have standing to sue these perpetrators that are, I mean, I submit, you know, they're worse than perpetrators. But the bottom line is that nobody's creating a safety valve. Nobody's creating a bubble of protection. The people who are being paid billions of dollars of taxpayer money to ensure safety and that some, you know, creative idea is made up so that, you know, we don't have these terrorist attacks anymore, or they're extraordinarily limited. I mean, the people are funding them. It's crazy that, I mean, I submit the people who are supposed to protect us are sliding the oil to allow some of these things to happen. I mean, really, I take it as far as saying aiding and abetting. I really do.
Well, I agree, and I sometimes wonder why we don't go after members of Congress under Bivens, because I think they're acting outside of not only their oaths of office, but their scope of authority. But, you know, here's something that's really interesting. You were talking about where else the danger exists of indoctrination. There was a story, gosh, it has to be about 5 years ago, I'm going to guess. And it was about how a school bus driver in Toronto, Canada, was using his job as a school bus driver for a couple of things that had nothing to do with driving a bus. He was driving teenage boys. He tried to recruit them into a terror cell that he was trying to establish in Toronto, believe it or not. And he was using the school bus to do surveillance. He was using the school bus for camouflage. And he was using the students, and these were high school kids, so they were somewhere between the ages of, I guess, 14 and 17 or 14 and 18. He was trying to proselytize them to convince them to become terrorists in Canada. And I remember getting contacted by the Canadian media, and I said, look, this is why we need to require passports of people traveling between Canada and the United States and Canada and Mexico, Because up until that point, travel within the Western Hemisphere, if you were an American, all you had to do was declare yourself to be an American. There was no specific identity document. And I said, that's crazy. Well, as soon as I got quoted in the Canadian media, the Canadian government reached out to me the following week. I think I was interviewed like on a Friday. They published the story the next day. Monday or Tuesday, I got two phone calls simultaneously. While I'm on one call, I got a call from the other. And I was called by the Canadian Embassy in Washington and by the Canadian Senate up in, I believe it was Ottawa, at the Banking and Commerce Committee that had oversight over what was to be done with what was then known as the Western Hemisphere Travel Initiative, requiring passports to travel between the countries. And I remember I was already scheduled to be in Washington that Friday. They invited me for coffee at the embassy. So I said, look, I'm supposed to, and it's unusual, not to testify at a congressional hearing before the Immigration Subcommittee in the House, but I was asked by the then chairman of the Immigration Subcommittee, John Hostetler, a great guy, and he was a tremendous chairman. I worked closely with him. I think I did about seven or eight hearings for John. And his people called me up and said, we'd love for you to attend two hearings that we're holding and take notes and give us your thoughts from what you hear, which I did. And then after that, I was invited to a dinner for an award ceremony. So I said, you know what? I have a block of about 4 hours where I'll be all dressed up with nowhere to go. So it was at that time that I hopped in a cab, went to the Canadian embassy and met with their people for 4 hours and was able to convince them that the Western Hemisphere Travel Initiative was, in fact, a very important document. It was a very important process. And I eventually convinced them that I was right. And it was ratified, I believe, about 4 months later. But the point that I'm making is that across the world, we keep seeing the same sort of things. We are allowing corporations that make campaign finances, we're allowing them to make national security decisions. We are allowing people who run hotels and know how to hopefully deliver clean sheets to bedrooms to decide on what the proper procedure is in the issuance of visas, which involves nothing less than national security. How in the world do we allow people with no knowledge of national security make national security decisions for the United States of America, especially in this perilous era when we know that we are just one day away from the next terrible news story about a terrorist attack?
Well, you're absolutely right. And, I mean, I love the line of thinking about the Bivens exception. And if I could sue one person in particular, I'd like to get all of his campaign money. If I could just get Lindsey Graham's campaign money. You know, I mean, this is what the bottom line is that these servant leaders, they go up there, and whether their hearts are in the right place or not to begin with, they get so twisted.
Are you suggesting a physical for these guys to make sure their hearts are in the right place?
Yeah, let's see if they have one, just because, you know. I mean,
let's see. Exactly. Let's start with making sure they have a heart to begin with.
Yeah, and then let's do one of those psychological evaluations that you have, you know, on testing whether they're competent or not to know the difference between the truth and a lie. Let's see if we can find that out.
And then maybe find out where they get a lot of their funding from besides these front organizations.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, that's really the shame of the whole thing. And it's just an infiltration at high levels of, you know, everybody's got an agenda, but when you start looking at, like, you know, the people, and I hate to even talk about it because it's not that much fun when you go out there and start saying things like Al-Shabaab. Who wants to say that over and over again? But, you know, these guys, where are they getting their money and their ability to train in places that are like daycare centers or mosques or
let's go to one other story before we run out of time, because I did put out an email earlier, and here's something I want you to know about. CNN just a couple of hours ago reported that President Obama heard from the Iranian president, and I have to tell you, and here's some insight that I want to provide you, and especially I want to provide the audience. In 1979, when the U.S. embassy was overrun at Tehran, I was an immigration agent. And they came to us and said, you're going to go out there and look for the Iranian students, because they were demonstrating and they were protesting and they worried about spies. They worried about saboteurs, rightfully so. We couldn't find our backsides with a flashlight. Most of these people had put down addresses on their arrival document, hotel in New York. Okay, imagine that. Hotel in New York. Boy, now there's an investigative lead. We could figure that out real quick. I mean, do you know how many hotels are in New York City?
It sounds like a Monty Python movie.
And
right?
They're still doing it, by the way. Even after 9/11, this nonsense is still being played out. So, hotel in New York, and you said, oh my gosh, now what do we do? So we kept trying to find these people, and it was ridiculous. And then there was a demonstration in Washington that turned violent. The Washington, D.C. police arrested hundreds of Iranians who were in their late teens, early 20s. They were students, supposedly. And they sent the men up to Otisville Prison in upstate New York, and the women were brought to the detention center in Manhattan, and we were split in two groups. One group went up to Otisville, one group stayed in New York. I drew the short straw. I wound up in New York. I don't know if it was a short straw, but that was my assignment. And we were told they're going to be here by 9 o'clock tonight, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 1 o'clock, 3 o'clock. I finally said, why don't we all go home and get a night's sleep? Anybody who has the capacity to keep you waiting has the capacity to run the show. So my bosses finally said, all right, go home. We came back. We were told that the names they gave the Washington police were lies. This goes back again to who are you? They had no identity documents, and these people spoke Farsi. We didn't realize it, and the Washington, D.C. police didn't realize it, but they gave names that were body parts. Use your imagination. There were names that were curses, you know, screw you, up yours, in Farsi. So suddenly, I said, where is so-and-so?
Yeah.
I'm sorry?
I may actually start learning Farsi. I'm not kidding.
Well,
either,
and by the way, why are we still not teaching our ICE agents these foreign languages? We used to be required to learn Spanish. Now they're requiring zero foreign languages. This is a vulnerability that I've spoken about at I don't know how many congressional hearings. Still ignored. 12 years after 9/11, almost 21 years since the first attacks of 21 years since the first attacks of 93 at the CIA and the Trade Center. So you look at the lunacy. What haven't we learned? What aren't we willing to do? So
I don't know.
If you look at this madness.
It's alternative universe. I feel like sometimes I'm on synthetic drugs. And then
but here's what
when
I want.
I watch
but here's
Diane
the point.
Feinstein. Yeah.
Well, wait a moment. I just wanted to make my point, and then I'll get to what you wanted to say. So here's the deal. They eventually admitted that those weren't really their names. We allowed them to play by the rules that they wrote. We could only ask them 8 questions. They got to provide a translator that we couldn't challenge. It went on and on and on. So the embassy was overrun because of Jimmy Carter. We wound up with Khomeini. We wound up with the revolution in Iran when you had non-secular Iranians trying to overthrow the madness of Iran. This administration did nothing to support their efforts. So now they've got a new president who says, oh, I want to make nice, and everybody's ready to go play suck-up. Does anybody understand that people lie? I mean, these are politicians. They don't know the truth. They know people lie because they're the practitioners themselves. But we have people saying, oh, the Iranians want to have a new relationship with us? Really?
Well,
even as their nuclear program goes full speed ahead and they keep on flying their shock troops into Venezuela? Just remember, a year and a half ago, do you remember just before the election, the Iranian shock troops were trying to kill the Saudi ambassador, blow up the Saudi embassy, and perhaps take out the Israeli embassy as well?
Yeah, I mean, they haven't stuttered. They don't stutter.
How naive and stupid are we? And then you look at what we're doing in California, where I don't know if they've done it yet or they're proposing it, that illegal aliens should be able to sit on juries. They are trying to pass something they call the Trust Act, and I wrote a piece about this for Californians for Population Stabilization, capsweb.org, and they said that the goal of the Trust Act is that the police would not be able to honor detainers lodged by ICE that say, this guy that you have in custody, we want him. And they're saying, well, you know what? If he doesn't have a serious conviction, we're not even going to talk to ICE. Meanwhile, this is the embedding tactic of choice of terrorists, to get into the country one way or the other, not get arrested. Just because you haven't been arrested doesn't mean you're not a threat. Mohammed Atta had no arrest record in the United States. He was never arrested in the United States, but he was the mastermind, the leader of the 2001 attack. So a foreign national...
I have to tell you.
Am I crazy?
No. And I feel like I'm on synthetic drugs. And Dianne Feinstein is the chairman of the narcotic drug thing, and she's also the chairman of the intelligence committee. So we are.
Well, there's
really,
an oxymoron.
Yeah. What's that?
No, I'm saying the idea of Dianne Feinstein on an intelligence committee.
I know.
That's
it's
a better
so
oxymoron
funny.
Than jumbo shrimp.
Or happily married. You got it. I know. It's insane. Honest lawyer. Yeah. But listen, you know what, Mike? It is actually 8 o'clock. I'm so blessed because I am going to go to some rural place in South Carolina, like waking up at 5:30 in the morning, and I'm going to do my first skeet shoot with Clays. So I'm really excited about it. It's going to benefit veterans. So that's going to be a lot of fun. Our military, just God bless them, and I love them. I have to tell you, there's a word that the definition I think is important for people to know, and it's caliphate, and it's, you know, I mean, because when you really look at what motivates people to do what they do, like what we started out talking about, you know, how does somebody wake up one day and just decide to engage in the behaviors that resulted in the carnage, you know, in Kenya? I think we have to look at history here. I think it's important for Americans to become educated. I think that your articles are absolutely amazing. They're crucial. I wish that they were in every single, you know, high school and junior high school across the United States. I wish that Bill Gates would have pulled you in on the Common Core curriculum. You know, but it's just about education. It's about critical thinking. It's about situational awareness. And as always, I'm so honored to be on your program.
Well, I'm always delighted to have you join me to provide your insight and your wisdom. I hope that the things go the right way so I can join you again in January, presuming you have another conference down in Myrtle Beach.
I believe that they are on the schedule, working on something like that. So,
Mike Cutler wants to come down and do it again.
I will. I absolutely will. And maybe we can get you some other things across the state too. That would be wonderful.
Well, and you know, one of the other things I'm really excited about, my friend Cindy Pugh, who is a state legislator in Minnesota, they are having me come to Minnesota in just about 4 weeks, and we are going to be having a discussion on the impact of immigration and why immigration is the singular issue that impacts just about every challenge and threat that we're facing. And this isn't anti-immigrant, folks. The difference between an immigrant and an illegal alien is comparable to the difference between a house guest and a burglar. Just because you lock your doors and windows at night before you go to sleep when you're warned that there are home invaders wandering around your neighborhood doesn't make you antisocial. It makes you prudent. And I'm not saying keep everybody out. I'm a New Yorker, and I love the diversity that we have, especially in New York. But it's about making certain that we don't permit people into our country who would do harm to us. You know, with all the talk of how do you keep the terrorists out of the malls and keep the terrorists off of the airplanes, why doesn't anybody ask how do we keep terrorists out of the United States in the first place?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, and you know what? I really like and respect Cindy Pugh. I haven't met her yet, but we've been in communication. She is a great lady. So I'm looking forward to hearing how that develops too. But I'm going to sign off for now. Good night, Mike, and God bless. Talk to you later.
Okay, thanks so much for joining me, Laura. And I'm going to stay with you folks for just a little bit longer, so don't go anywhere. Just to wrap up a couple of loose ends, you know, this program, what I've been trying to accomplish, having friends like Lauren Martell and others on this show, has been all about educating people about an issue that the media, for the most part, won't discuss. I've been on with Neil Cavuto a bunch of times, and I think Neil has the integrity and the reasonableness to be willing to have these conversations. I was on with Megyn Kelly not long ago. I hope she's listening this evening. She does a great job over at Fox. But what's remarkable is that there was a time shortly after 9/11 when I was appearing on perhaps 15 television programs per month. I'd be going from one studio to another studio, back to another studio. And today, the immigration issue is all but ignored. The discussions have been quieted. The dissension is not being tolerated. This isn't what America is supposed to be about. You know, this idea that it's anti-immigrant to enforce the immigration laws is wrong. In fact, the people most at risk from the violence perpetrated by transnational gangs are the members of the immigrant communities. Because of the simple fact that transnational gangs, as their name implies, span countries, span nations. They have a foot in two or more countries simultaneously. So they are in the position to go to somebody within the immigrant community who still has family members back home and say to that guy, hey, listen, we know where your mother lives in Moscow or in Beijing or in Tokyo or wherever. Because we're not just talking about Latin America, folks. We are talking about criminal organizations that operate in all the countries around the world. I've arrested criminal aliens in my 30-year career from just about every continent save Antarctica. So we've seen this, you know, whether they're from Asia, whether they're from Europe, whether they're from Africa or the Caribbean or Latin America or Central America or Canada. And they are in the position to do harm to family members of the immigrants if they don't cooperate with the thugs. Now, cooperation might simply mean don't talk to the police, or it might mean that they will be tasked with moving a suitcase from New York to Chicago, or as we've seen in Washington Heights with the Dominican drug gangs, they will approach an elderly couple and say to the couple, we're going to give you a choice. Either you accept the proposition or you're in a lot of trouble, but we'll give you a couple $1,000s so we can use your apartment for 3 days. You will go to a hotel tomorrow morning. You will not come back until, you know, Thursday morning. And what they would do is actually conduct a rolling series of drug transactions in some old couple's apartment, and they would go from apartment to apartment to apartment to make it that much more difficult for law enforcement to surveil them, track them, and figure out where they were operating out of. And if the old couple said they weren't interested in that, a family member might get shot or they might get shot. Happening right here in America, happening right here in New York City, happening in towns and cities across America. And what these folks all had in common is that they were of the same ethnicity as the thugs who were doing this. And again, this isn't about Latin America. It's about criminals from all over the world. First and foremost, law enforcement's job is to keep innocent people safe, irrespective of whether they're citizens or not. So to hear this nonsense, that it's anti-immigrant to enforce the laws to keep out the criminals, the terrorists, the thugs, the drug dealers. We're told that, you know, arrests are down, arrests are up. I was on Neil Cavuto quite some time ago, within the last year at least, though. And Neil said, well, you know, Mike, arrests are down, so doesn't that mean that there are fewer illegal aliens in the United States? And I said, you know, Neil, trying to determine how many illegal aliens are present in the country based on arrest statistics is a bit like taking attendance by asking people not present to raise their hand. Well, Neil thought it was pretty funny, and I got emails afterwards from other people who thought it was quite funny. But in reality, that's essentially what you're talking about. This doesn't work. What does work is if we're smart enough to enforce the immigration laws in a way that we keep the criminals out, that we keep the criminals off the street, and when they do get in, that we put them on the next airplane out of here. Simply saying that cities and states could be sanctuaries and ignore the immigration laws and undermine national security and undermine the immigration laws of the United States, which also cause Americans to lose their jobs or suffer lower wages because labor is a commodity, is outrageous. So what's really remarkable is that while California, for example, is taking up legislation that would block police from cooperating with ICE and ICE detainers, which would seem to me to be a crime, there's several statutes involved, but let's start with Title 8, United States Code, Section 1324, aiding, abetting, encouraging, harboring, inducing, smuggling, and shielding. But I guarantee you that this administration will take no punitive action against California for refusing to cooperate with immigration, even while they had sued Arizona for coming up with legislation that largely paralleled the immigration laws that this administration won't enforce. The actions taken by this and prior administrations call into question that very eloquent expression of Abraham Lincoln when he talked about a government by the people, for the people, and of the people. And I think I'm getting the sequence wrong, but you know that famous expression that Abraham Lincoln used. The bottom line, ladies and gentlemen, is that we the people have got to get our voices heard by our elected representatives. And I'll just give you two or three quick ways that comprehensive reform is being pushed on a lie, and that will be it for this evening. But we're told, and we've heard this from some of the Republicans on the other side of the fence, oh, we're not going to provide a pathway to citizenship for illegal aliens. We'll just give them lawful status so they can work here. Most aliens who come here to work. Only about two-thirds of all of the aliens or less, only two-thirds or less of the aliens eligible to apply for citizenship actually do so. Most are happy to keep a green card and not even become an American citizen. And many of the people who become American citizens only do so because they know they can retain dual nationality, which is, I think, problematic. So you have that going on. And now you're being told, well, we won't give them citizenship, but we'll give them lawful status. The problem is, if you look at the 9/11 Commission report and if you look at common sense, that's a risk to national security. The idea of providing unknown millions of illegal aliens with identity documents, where there are so many applications to be processed that nobody gets interviewed and no field investigations are being conducted, this would simply provide official identity documents to people who, if they're bad guys, are lying about their names, when they got here, and even what country they're from. This is the embedding tactic that was used by the terrorists. The idea that there are members of Congress who would not take into account the findings and recommendations of the 9/11 Commission is outrageous. I don't care what party you're from. Go back and look at the 9/11 Commission report. We hear all the screaming about why wasn't Snowden properly investigated. For those of you who remember, who have forgotten his name, he was the guy who leaked the NSA secrets, and he's now been convicted. You look at the shooter at the Washington Navy Yard. How could he have a security clearance? How do they do his background? Well, why aren't you concerned that we're providing identity documents to criminals and terrorists in the United States with no background investigation? At least those guys had background investigations that may have been flawed. The jury's out on that. They really should do an investigation into how the investigations were done. But we are giving people identity documents without even interviewing them in person. And yet, we are being scrutinized ever more closely when we get on board airplanes. Our movement is being tracked between the easy pass that we have and the cell phone GPS tracking and everything else. We've lost just about 90%, I'm going to guess, of our Fourth Amendment expectation of privacy. But at the same time, in the name of, well, we do that in the name of national security. At the same time, we are giving illegal aliens identity documents. And when people sneak into the country, we don't know why they did it covertly. Yes, maybe they're just looking for a job, but it may also be that they're wanted for heinous crimes in another country, or that they're part of criminal or terrorist organizations looking to set up shop in America. We don't know. How can you give people identity documents when you don't know their names or why they're here? Yet this is exactly what the current administration is doing, and what people who favor any kind of lawful benefit to mass numbers of illegal aliens are advocating, to provide millions of people with identity documents. I don't care if they're resident aliens. I don't care if they're called temporary work authorized aliens. They can give them whatever title they want. The idea of giving people identity documents in a system that has no integrity, you may as well be able to get on board an airplane and scribble your name on an index card and have that treated as though it was a secure identity document, because it's not the fancy plastic covering on the document that makes it significant. What hopefully makes that identity document significant is the vetting process that preceded the issuance of the card. If there is no vetting process, you should be able to just tell the guy your name and write it on an index card with a magic marker for all that it's worth. And that's what we're doing. And we're doing it to placate people who make money off of the exploitation of cheap labor. And that includes the high-tech workers. When we are told that America will not succeed if we don't bring in foreign students, and that if those foreign students can't get a green card and be allowed to stay here permanently, that American companies lose the benefit of those hard-working students, because they're all going to be brilliant entrepreneurs. We know that because we've been told this by people like Bill Gates and all these other characters. In point of fact, In the old days, Americans got those jobs. In the old days, when there was a shortage of labor, whether it was bricklayers or plumbers like my dad or engineers, the Labor Department went to the schools and did what they could to encourage Americans to go into those fields where there was a shortage, not bring them in from overseas. If you're truly worried that a student who acquires an education and skills won't stay in America and apply those skills here inside the United States, we don't need to give alien students green cards. We need to give American students seats in those universities. Then when they get their degree, instead of traveling across the world, they will travel cross-country to their apartment not far from where they got their education. That's how you build America. That's how you secure the middle class and the American dream for Americans. And if you look at the minority population in the United States, blacks, Latinos, their unemployment and poverty rates are even higher than that for everybody else. This isn't about racism, folks. There are too many people out there that think that by using the term racism, they will get people to run scared. Well, I'm not running scared because I know better, and I know that you know better also. It's not racist to say let's take care of our own first. When, God forbid, there's a building fire or a boat capsizes or some other tragedy, it's common sense that the parents will take whatever risks they have to take to try to save their own children. And they'll save their own kids before they save someone else's child. Yes, if you can go back into that burning building and save someone else's kid, of course we're going to do that. But nobody could ever possibly criticize a parent for saving their own first. And nobody should ever criticize an American who says, let's save the middle class for Americans of every race, every religion, and every ethnicity before we provide opportunities for people from other countries. I think it's American Express who says that membership has its rewards. I'd like to see a similar motto that says citizenship has its rewards. It's time that the American people came to expect from their own government that Americans would get first dibs, that the actions and the laws and the priorities of the government of the United States would be to first and foremost look out for citizens of the United States. Well, it's at the end of the program. I'm glad you guys joined me. I hope you have a wonderful weekend coming up. Again, I'm going to remind you of the two great websites that I would love for you guys to go visit. It's capsweb.org, C-A-P-S, capsweb.org, to my friends in beautiful downtown Santa Barbara. Have a great weekend. And, of course, please go visit my website, michaelcutler.net. Hope you like both websites. If you do, pass them along to your friends and neighbors. Let's try to create a bucket brigade of truth. And please remember, folks, democracy is not a spectator sport. Make certain to get your voice heard by your alleged political representatives. Have a great weekend, folks. See you next week. So long for now.